Tonight on the Daily Debrief.
Get your hands up. Get your hands up.
Prosecutors build their case against a former cop accused of gunning down a black motorist stranded on the highway. Who was the first aggressor? Plus, closing arguments in the case against a man accused of killing a Florida mother.
A bitter custody battle going on.
Does the ex-husband, not the defendant, really have an airtight alibi? Also, the president's former personal attorney testifies before Congress. The nation's top criminal cases are on the Daily Debrief. It's Wednesday, February 27th.
And good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Debrief. Judge Ashley Wilcott, Attorney Donald Papsy, great to have you here. It's going to be a great discussion. Let's get straight to it. Day two of testimony in the trial of a Florida police officer who faces an attempted murder charge for shooting and killing a stranded African-American motorist. Newman Raja also faces a charge of manslaughter regarding the 2015 shooting death of Corey Jones. Jones was stranded on the side of an interstate exit ramp. Raja shot him and claims it was self-defense. Witnesses testified they heard gunfire. It was a series of shots, then a pause, then other shots.
I heard three gunshots, a pause, and then three more.
Okay. And what were you doing when these gunshots went off the first time?
I was asleep. They woke me up.
So, and you heard three shots initially?
I did.
Do you know about what time in the morning this was, sir?
It was around 3 or 3:15 a.m.
And how do you know that?
Well, I had a clock in my room, and I do remember looking at it, but I went back to sleep, and then just looked at the clock.
Okay. And how much time, generally, if you can tell at all, did it take between the first round of gunshots and the second round of gunshots?
I'm not 100% sure on that, but what I can tell you is that when I originally heard the first three shots, I woke up and I had time to sit there and think, that sounded like gunshots, and started dozing back off and then heard three more. So it was several seconds.
You're asleep in your bed. You hear gunshots while you're still asleep?
Yes.
And is that when you woke up?
Yeah, that's what woke me up.
Did you, after hearing the gunshots, what did you do?
After hearing the gunshots, I woke up. I just got out of bed very quickly, you know, trying to almost run. I stopped briefly at the foot of my friend's bed and shook her and said, I heard gunshots, call 911. And then I ran out onto the balcony.
About how many shots did you hear? Do you recall?
Initially, when it woke me up, I would say 2 to 3 shots I heard initially.
Was there a pause, and then you heard more shots?
There was, yeah. There was. The initial shots woke me up, and then there was a brief pause, and then I heard another round of 2 to 3 shots following that. I saw a gentleman holding a gun and stepping backwards from the area, walking backwards, holding a gun in one hand and his cell phone in another hand.
The first responding officer described his conversation at the scene with Newman Raja.
He told me that Mr. Jones, later determined Mr. Jones, that he had a gun and that he had ordered him to drop it, and he believed he had shot him. He then told me that the subject ran north in the grass between the off-ramp and the Doubletree Hotel, and he said he saw him throw what he believed was a silver gun, because he said he had a silver gun in the grass behind Mr. Jones' vehicle.
The key piece of evidence in this case is a call the victim made for roadside assistance. That call was recorded. The state thinks it proves Raja was the first aggressor. The victim's brother compared the tone of the call for help to this earlier conversation.
He was very calm. He wasn't flustered or nothing like that. I just know that he was concerned about his drums and ready to get home because he already played.
Just pause. Pause for a second.
Did he sound angry at all?
No.
Did he sound as if he was impaired at all?
No.
Have you listened to a recording of an AT&T roadside assistance call from October 18th of 2015 from approximately 3 in the morning, sir?
Yes.
You recognize the person on that call?
Yes.
Who was that person?
That was Corey.
Any doubt about it?
No doubt.
He sounded the same on that recording initially as he had sounded when you talked to him?
He sounded like he was every day.
Did that change at the end of that call?
Yeah.
Raja was wearing plain clothes and was in an unmarked van when he pulled up behind Corey Jones. According to that testimony, Jones was scared and went for his gun. The prosecutor again argues that Officer Raja was indeed the first aggressor.
He jumps out. He's got no indication whatsoever he's a law enforcement officer. He's wearing jeans. He's wearing an inside-out t-shirt, a hat. No badge, nothing. You'll hear, when he jumps out of that van, you'll hear something fast, real fast, real short, and Corey Jones' response is, huh? I'm good. That's his response. With as much effect as that. And what's the response from our law enforcement officer on duty that's supposed to be helping a stranded citizen? Really? Yeah, I'm good. Really? That's what he's saying. That's not how an officer talks to a citizen at 3 o'clock in the morning on the side of the road. He's actually chasing Corey Jones away from his vehicle. Corey's already retreating back out of his doorway to the back of his vehicle. A citizen that's stranded on the side of the road, already being chased from his vehicle by an officer who's sitting there saying, really? And when Corey Jones lastly says, yeah, now you start saying even more hostile. Get your hands up. Get your hands up. That's what he's screaming. That's how he's treating a stranded citizen.
The defense repeated several times that their theory of this case is one of self-defense because Jones drew his gun first and Raja reacted. Never mind that Raja pulled up without a uniform in an unmarked car and never identified himself as a cop.
This is a terribly sad and tragic case. It's an example of a perfect storm that turned deadly when Corey Jones pointed a loaded handgun at Newman Raja. Mr. Jones pointed the handgun at Mr. Raja not once, but twice. And each time Mr. Raja fired, he was acting to defend himself. This area around the barrel of the gun is going to become extremely important. The morning this incident occurred, Mr. Raja gave a voluntary cooperative statement to investigators. When he gave that video walkthrough, he told the investigators that he saw something very specific when Corey Jones pointed the firearm at him. He said that he saw a red flickering light around the barrel of the handgun when Mr. Jones pointed it at him. The state made a very powerful opening statement, much of it based upon emotion. We're going to lay out the facts of the case, which is what you need to determine your verdict in this case. The judge will tell you that emotion should not play a part in your verdict. Facts should.
A crime scene investigator today testified that he was unable to recreate the flickering red light, which Raja apparently thought was caused by a flickering laser sight. A solid red light, however, flickering and reflecting rather off the gun, might have been caused by a reflection from a red traffic light.
Did that appear to be a Laser Max laser to you?
It did not appear to be. That gun has an enclosed guide rod anyway. That gun wouldn't be compatible with the Laser Max laser. we tried to get the red reflectivity and the flicker pattern. We got the red. We tried from several different angles, and we couldn't get the same flicker pattern or any flicker pattern. I was able to get I was able to view it with my eyes, and I was actually able to capture it with the camera, with the red traffic signal reflecting off the front of the pistol.
Joining me tonight here on The Debrief are Judge Ashley Wilcott and Attorney Donald Papsy. Good to see you both.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Okay, so this flickering light, they couldn't recreate it with a laser sight. Is it evidence that Newman Raja, this ex-cop, is lying about what he saw that night? Ashley, what do you think?
I don't know that it's evidence that he's lying. I think he may have said, this is what I thought I saw, but the evidence does create reasonable doubt that what he thought he saw is really what he saw.
Okay, Donald, let me ask this one. Raja fired, paused, and then fired again. Is that pause what prosecutors are going for here to try to say this is a calculated design necessary for a first-degree murder charge?
I think that's exactly what they'll do. That's what they need, because the immediate response is what the defense will argue that he needed to do to protect himself under his defense. And that pause and then the 2 seconds later is what gives rise to more premeditated action.
Jump in as you wish, both of you. Who's the first aggressor here? Is it Raja for pulling up and becoming belligerent, as the prosecutor says, or is the first aggressor the victim here?
From what I've heard so far, it looks like when he got out of the car, and even though he's approaching him, I don't believe he's approaching him in an overly aggressive manner. He's asking him, are you good, are you good? But that doesn't mean he's attacking him, that he should feel threatened. So I'm not really sure at this point.
I feel the opposite. I think if he did not, in fact, identify himself as the police, even though he says he thinks he did, he wasn't dressed as a police officer, that can be perceived by a person stranded as aggressive. They don't know who this is or what this person's going to do to them.
And we have the brother testifying that the victim had fear in his voice during that roadside assist call, and we're waiting for that to come out in court. One thing I've got to sort of complain about here a little bit, what is up with the defense constantly saying, oh, this is a sad thing, it was sad that the victim died, and it'll be even sadder if you convict my client, this is the defense. Why are they saying all of that and then saying, oh, don't make your decision based on emotion? So which is it? Are they being contradictory right off the bat?
It's every single case I've ever handled like this is exactly the same thing. It's an emotional case, and you don't want the jury, in this case, you want to slow down the action and take the emotion out of it and stick to the facts.
We could have a big debate about why this is an attempted murder charge when the victim is dead. I tried to look for answers. Judge Wilcott, I think you did too.
I did too, and I wasn't able to find one. So I know that they're looking at culpable negligence, but I'm not sure why it's not a first-degree murder versus attempted murder.
I'm curious. I'm going to have to ask a Florida expert. We'll check in with you both at the end of the broadcast on our next case. Still ahead, speaking of that next case, closing arguments in that Florida murder trial where a man is accused of killing a mother of three. Did a custody dispute cause the defendant to help out his friend who was fighting with the victim over children? Or did botched police work lead to the wrong man? We take you back inside the courtroom after the break. Welcome back to The Debrief. The former attorney for President Donald Trump has testified before Congress about his work for the president. Michael Cohen appeared today before the House Oversight Committee. Republicans rebuked him for being a lying felon and characterized him as untruthful. Democrats tried to get answers about the president's businesses, campaign, and personal practices. Here are some of Cohen's opening remarks.
Mr. Trump did not directly tell me to lie to Congress. That's not how he operates. In conversations we had during the campaign, at the same time I was actively negotiating in Russia for him, he would look me in the eye and tell me there's no Russian business, and then go on to lie to the American people by saying the same thing. In his way, he was telling me to lie. There were at least a half a dozen times between the Iowa caucus in January of 2016 and the end of June when he would ask me, how's it going in Russia? Referring to the Moscow Tower project.
Republicans hit back hard and Cohen fought back.
You wanted to work in the White House.
No,
you
sir.
You didn't get brought to the dance.
Sir.
And now?
I was extremely proud to be personal attorney to the President of the United States of America. I did not want to go to the White House. I was offered jobs. I can tell you a story of Mr. Trump reaming out Reince Priebus because I had not taken a job where Mr. Trump wanted me to.
You failed to report $4 million in income to the Internal Revenue Service. Did you do that to protect Donald Trump?
No, I did not. I just find it interesting, sir, that between yourself and your colleagues, that not one question so far since I'm here has been asked about President Trump. That's actually why I thought I was coming today, not to confess the mistakes that I've made. I've already done that.
It was snarky. Deeper coverage and analysis of the Cohen testimony is on lawandcrime.com. The defense now has the case of a Florida man accused of murdering a mother of three. David Russell Holbrook Jr. is facing the charges following the death of Melissa Howard. Her daughter found her stabbed and beaten in 2006. The victim had just won a child custody battle against her ex-husband, Brian. Brian was a friend to the defendant. The ex-husband himself was at a large party, giving him, at least what the prosecution says, is an alibi for the time of the killing. The prosecution said Holbrook's changing stories about his own timeline make him look guilty. The state's argument involved the slick use of graphics and clips from actual testimony. Here are a few key points.
We know there was a custody battle going on at this time for Taylor Howard. You heard from Janice Burke that Melissa Howard was successful in petitioning the court for primary custody of Taylor. She was slated to get full custody on January 6, 2006, the same day that she was killed. The defendant claimed he had not been to Melissa's house or even seen Melissa in years. Years! The truth is, he was at her house 2 days before her murder. The defendant's timeline for his activities that Friday changed every time he told it. On January 25th of 2006, he said he left the house at 8:30, stopped by Walmart, and was back by 9 o'clock. And that version of his story, the only time he left his house was between 8:30 and 9. He left at 8:30, dropped his kids off, and was home by 9. That's not what he said on February 1st, 2006. He said he left his house at 8:40 or 8:45. He arrived exactly at 9 o'clock, stopped by now a gas station in Walmart, and then arrived home between 9:20 and 9:30, 9:15, 9:30. It keeps changing, though. February 7th, 2006, he will say that he left his house at 8:20. When the officer repeats it back to him, he says, no, 8:40. Dropped his kids off right at 9 o'clock, stopped by a gas station at Walmart, and then arrived home at roughly 9:30. Let's talk about his actual timeline. If he left to take the kids home at 8:20 or 8:30, both of which are versions of his stories, not my words, his. If that version of the story is true, the kids would have been home by 8:35 or 8:45 because he said it takes 15 minutes to get there. We know there was a phone call from the defendant to Gina at 9:29 p.m. And we know that he and Michael entered Walmart at 9:35 or 9:37. Ladies and gentlemen, Russell Holbrook had plenty of time to kill Melissa Howard before he went to Walmart. Under this scenario, he had almost an hour.
The defense says the state's timeline does not work and that this defendant had no motive to commit murder for his friend, the victim's ex-husband. Instead, the defendant's brother was friends with the ex, and the ex's alibi isn't airtight, the defense says.
You've heard no testimony that Russell and Brian Howard were close friends, much less enough for Russell to murder someone as a favor for Brian Howard. I mean, we've heard no connections as to why Brian Howard would somehow convince or get Russell Holbrook to do something for him. They weren't good friends. Now, Michael Holbrook and Brian Howard, they knew each other. They had worked together. They had done jobs. And all you heard about Brian Howard, we heard from a lot of witnesses about the Azteca restaurant that night, and everybody seems to agree that people came home and it was roughly around the 9 o'clock hour, but that Brian goes upstairs never to be seen from again.
Let's turn again to Attorney Donald Papsy and Judge Ashley Wilcott. So we've got a lot of defense what ifs here. No force entry. The defense says the victim was afraid of this defendant over that altercation where he wound up basically threatening her a few days before. So she wouldn't have let him in. He would have had to break in, and therefore that's a sign that he didn't do it. Donald, what do you make of that?
I think that's very smart. I think the PowerPoint presentation of the prosecutor is actually better than his actual argument. I just don't see, they place this defendant at the scene 2 days before, but no evidence actually places him anywhere near the scene of the crime on the day it actually happened.
You've got that little scrap of DNA on the sweatshirt that the victim was wearing, but he says that was deposited during the previous threatening visit, if we're to take the attorney at her word. But a couple of other strange things here. Two beer bottles in the house, Judge Wilcott. One with the victim's DNA, one was in the garbage and it wasn't tested.
And I think that was a great argument by defense. Aaron, if you look at his closing argument, the defenses, and you put it all together, I think it equals reasonable doubt because he talks about that. Beer bottles that weren't tested, DNA that wasn't tested on another package, all the moving parts, the theory of when the time frames were that don't match what the defense say it's possible to actually commit that crime. All of that adds up.
The victim was having an affair with someone who was a married man. He was a UPS truck driver. Blood on the UPS truck wasn't tested. Again, reasonable doubt. Donald, what do you think?
Of course, it's all reasonable doubt. That's all. Every single part of the case is reasonable doubt. There really is actually no evidence at all that this man, this defendant, was there at the day of the scene of the crime.
Jurors got instructed late today. Deliberations are presumably beginning either today or first thing in the morning. So both of your votes are acquittal because the state didn't prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. That's what I'm hearing?
Correct.
That's what I think, too. There's just too many holes in the case of the prosecution for me to believe he'll be convicted.
Okay, one other interesting little point about this is, you know, is the ex-husband, who really was in the custody dispute, could he have somehow snuck out? Was there time for him to do it? The defense raised that scepter, too.
Well, I think there was as much time as this defendant had to commit the crime. So what's the difference? I think either of them arguably could have done it, time-wise.
Wow, tough arguments here. The jury's got a lot to weigh through. Donald Papsy, Judge Ashley Wilcott, appreciate your insight here on The Debrief tonight.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you, Aaron.
We'll catch you next time. And thanks to those of you who are watching The Debrief. I'll be back tomorrow at 5 o'clock Eastern here on the Law & Crime Network. Our live trial coverage begins at 9 o'clock in the morning. We'll see you then.